This is Nancy Campbell interviewing Joyce Lowenson on March 16th, 2007. So what I'd like you to do is begin with your pathway into the field. What were your earliest experiences with addicted persons? Were there any sort of predisposing factors that tipped you towards studying them?
Well, it was really by chance that I became involved with the early research. I was a resident in psychiatry at the New York Medical College at Metropolitan Hospital, where they had a rather large narcotics service, addiction service. And the first night that I was on call, the chief resident said, "Don't bother going up to the narcotics ward, because the patients there will simply try to exploit you, they'll want to have medication, etc." So the first thing I did that night was to go up to the addiction ward.
And what year was that?
In 1964, beginning of 64. And there was a patient having a seizure, whom I was able to treat. Other patients did want medication, and there were a couple of musicians with whom I spent some time talking. One was Jackie McLean and the other was Sam Warren. And Sam wrote a little piece of music for me, and a couple of days later I received a phone call from Lorraine Nicewander, who had been on vacation and she had just gotten back, made her rounds on the ward, and these two men said, "Marie, there's another broad around who likes addicts." So Marie called me and invited me down to Rockefeller to review what she and Dr. Dole were doing. And she asked me if I would interrupt my residency to work with them, which I did. And
prior to that time, had you had any contact at all?
None at all. That's why I said it was inadvertent. So, but when I met the patients, that was really a signal moment for me. Marie Nicewander and her enthusiasm and her explanation to me of what they were doing. We were in the middle of a heroin epidemic, and so I was very much aware of the problems that existed, but I hadn't known about the research that they were doing. What Marie wanted me to do was to start the first inpatient unit down at Manhattan General. And we had all of six patients who could remain hospitalized for 6 weeks so they could be stabilized and to get some distance from the street. And toward the end of their hospitalization, we would give them one day off, and then we'd give them a weekend off, because we didn't want the transition from the hospital to the street to be too abrupt. And also, as a result of discharging patients, we had to have an outpatient unit. And so I started the first outpatient unit.
Now, at that point, Was that a methadone program?
Yes.
And
these were patients who were screened by Marie and admitted to the hospital.
At Metropolitan?
No.
That had not been a methadone program?
No.
What were you doing at Metropolitan? What was the nature of the care?
I was a resident in psychiatry, and I had very little to do with the addiction unit.
How did you, for instance, you said that you treated the seizures. How did you What did you use? What kinds of methods?
At that time, I really don't remember how we treated. The patients were withdrawing from chlorhydrate, and I think I used barbiturates to treat them.
So they were withdrawing from chlorhydrate?
They were withdrawing from a number of things.
Oh, I see.
But on the ward, it's really interesting to think back the history of what goes on in hospitals, in rehab units. Medications, drugs are smuggled in. So, and urines were not used to determine exactly what they were on.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So when you went to Manhattan General, that was under the aegis of starting a methadone program?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry, yes.
It was.
In Manhattan General. Right?
Okay, all right. Just want to get that straight.
That was the Bernstein Institute.
Yes, okay. All right. Now, did you work with Vincent Marie at Rockefeller at some point?
Yes, I did.
And was that before you
I went down to Beth Israel.
Okay. All right, so could you tell me when that intervened, in other words, in between your work at Metropolitan Hospital and your residency, then you interrupted your residency.
Well, during the last few months of my residency, I spent time at Rockefeller working primarily with Marie, but somewhat with Vince. And then the only real clinical experience I had there was taking three patients who were at the hospital. And that the methadone has an isomer. There are the DL isomers, the left and right. I think in Europe it's called R and S. And we thought the D isomer was totally inactive. And so we gave the patients their usual dose of methadone, but not the DL, just the D isomer. And after about 36 hours, one of the patients said he thought he was getting a cold. Mm-hmm. And before very long, the other two patients said, we must have been exposed to the same virus. And at that point, the early stages of withdrawal, we decided we'd give them their regular dose. So that was the only real clinical experience I had. I spent time talking to the patients, reviewing their history with them, and so. But it wasn't until I went down to Beth Israel that I had any real clinical experience extensively.
I see. All right, so what can you tell me about how Dahl and Niswander worked? Who else was in the lab at the time?
Well, at the time I was there, Norman Gordon, a psychologist, was there. And Enoch Gordas, but Enoch wasn't really working on the methadone program.
Yes. What was Robert Millman there?
No. Robert Newman. Or did
Millman.
You say
Millman. Millman.
No. Dr. Millman came in somewhat later.
Okay. And what about Elizabeth Curry?
She came in right after Millman.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But Bob started the adolescent program. Mm-hmm. Actually, Marie and he started it together, but he took that over. And then Liz Curie was hired.
And Ann Ho?
Ann Ho was working with Mary. Ann Ho was working for Dole at that time. And although I didn't see Mary Jean Creek at that period. She was a resident also, but she's a resident at Cornell. And during that period, very early on, she was drawing blood on the patients. And I think you can get more of the story from her.
Yes, I have.
Because she played a very important role. Mm-hmm. And she was a researcher. I was simply a clinician.
Yes, okay. And what do you remember about how that team worked together? Was there a division of labor? What did Vince do? What did Marie do? How did things work?
Well, this predates my coming on board. I'm not sure how much of this history you've gotten from Herman, but very briefly, there was a New York City committee looking into the addiction problem, and Matilda Prim was on it, and blocking the name.
Lewis Thomas?
Hmm?
Lewis Thomas?
Lewis Thomas.
Okay, so this was the New York City Health Research Council?
Right.
Okay.
And Lewis Thomas, I think he went on sabbatical. And Matilda Krim played a crucial role in persuading Dr. Dole to undertake this. He had become familiar with the problem. He used to take a train down from Westchester, and he got off at 125th Street and walked to Rockefeller. And he was very struck by the number of addicts he saw, and very sad, homeless-looking people. And prior to the decision that he would start to do some research on this, he had been a basic scientist. This was really the first clinical area that he entered. And before he undertook that work, he spent a lot of time with the lawyers of Rockefeller University, recognizing that there would be a lot of federal and other legal problems that he might encounter. And Detlev Bronk was the president of Rockefeller, and he supported Vince, and the program was launched. But it took a lot of preparation on his part. During the period when he was preparing for it, he read everything that was written on the subject.
Yes.
And the one thing that made sense to him was Marie Nyswider's book, Treating the Addict as a Patient. Mm-hmm. And so he called her. And Marie had the conviction that people could function on narcotics. We knew of musicians that functioned. There were physicians who functioned while taking Demerol and other opiates. So, and that's how they came together. They started that. With the idea of giving the patients morphine. And to their consternation, the patients were at the nurse's station every couple of hours asking for their next shot. Mm-hmm. And Vince decided that he would try a longer-acting opioid, which was methadone, and maybe the patients would bother the nurses every 6 hours instead of every 2 hours. And they were really struck by the total change. Instead of going to the nurse's station to ask for medication, they would ask the nurses what they could do to help with the other patients. And at that time, they were getting their medication by injection. And the patients themselves knew that that methadone was orally effective. And so they were switched to oral medication. And it turned out that they were able to take the medication once a day. And they didn't have the ups and downs. What Dole described as a three-layer cake, that the patients would wake up when they were taking heroin down here, and they'd get a shot, and then they would go up, and they'd go up and down. And what methadone did was to level them off in the middle layer of that cake. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting metaphor. I haven't heard that metaphor before. Yes. That's lovely.
And the patients began, there were two patients, and they began to think of their futures. One of them was a dropout from high school, a fellow named John McLaughlin, who decided he wanted to go back and finish school. And he finished his high school in a year, went to college, and then went on to get a PhD. And the other patient had an interest in horticulture, and so he was able to study that. And
so they experienced the return of interest in something other than
heroin. That they began to think of their futures. And these were both hardcore addicts and been using drugs for a long time.
And you were pretty familiar with them, with the patients.
I became familiar with them, that those. And so, and then Marie decided, when we started the unit down at Beth Israel, that by that time they had six patients at Rockefeller, that the patients themselves would become research assistants. Mm-hmm. And the reason I don't have much information to give you about that is that very shortly after I started, I had the inpatient unit with the patients, former patients as research assistants. One of whom actually gave me my indoctrination. I learned more from him than I could have learned from any teacher.
Yes.
And he remained on the staff at Beth Israel for a number of years. And
so tell me, what sorts of things did he convey in your indoctrination?
Well, in explaining to me what I just explained to you about the leveling off, how methadone allowed them not to have fluctuations in their mood, that they were able then to look forward to their future, to think what they wanted to do with their lives. And the fact that this was a medication that was, they could take orally instead of injecting as they had heroin, that it was long-acting, and that there were no mood changes with it.
So, when you began, tell me about the inception of the program that you began at Manhattan General. Did Marie set it up, or was it really your program?
Well, Marie originally, she screened all the patients. And she set it up, and I took it over. And then Harold Frigg, who was a physician, a psychiatrist at Manhattan General, was in charge of the detox unit. And Marie persuaded him to open a second unit, which had 9 beds.
How many beds did yours have?
Pardon me?
How many beds did yours
have? My unit had 6.
Okay.
So over the period of a year, a little less than a year, we had 75 patients in the outpatient clinic.
Mm-hmm. Because of the turnover.
Yeah.
I see. All right.
The patients remained in the hospital for 6 weeks. And when they were discharged, new patients could be admitted.
All right. And so now, what was the nature of your interaction with the patients?
Well, I would make rounds on the patients. I would spend time with each patient trying to determine what they were experiencing at the time.
Was there therapy? Was there group therapy or psychotherapy of any kind as well?
We didn't have group therapy, no.
So it was really just your
clinical encounters. Well, I functioned pretty much as a psychiatrist for them. Mm-hmm. But I was really not qualified. I had not finished my residency. But I spent a lot of time getting their histories and trying to help them through difficult periods, especially the first week or so that they were on. It was a difficult transition for them. And they were giving up something. Even though they wanted to give it up, it nevertheless was somewhat of a loss to them. And then when they were given passes to go out to prepare them for the kinds of problems they might encounter, and then learning from them the triggers, mm-hmm. and the determination that they had when they went back to their old neighborhoods, mm-hmm. Not to be, although they could be tempted, they never gave in to their temptations. And we took urines on the patients.
You did.
And the urines were not used for clinical purposes originally. The urines, what Dr. Dole had in mind was showing the progress that patients made over a period of a year. And there certainly were some patients who used heroin when they went out. They had to challenge the methadone to see if it really would work. Because one of the advantages was that it would block the effects of heroin. And so periodically we would see a little blip where a patient had used heroin. But after about 6 months, those blips disappear.
So tell me, as I understand it, Vince Dole had set up a urine testing thin layer
chromatography.
Mm-hmm. Did you use the same technique?
Yes.
And did you set up a lab where you were, or how did you?
Well, it all went to the same lab.
To his lab?
Yes.
Okay. All right. As I understand it, there were many contentions over dosage. Do you remember where you started out, and do you remember dosage being contentious in the very beginning, or did it become so later?
No. What Dole and Niswander had learned at Rockefeller is that most patients could be stabilized on a dose of about 100 to 120 milligrams. And we had one patient who had been a hardcore heroin and cocaine addict, and he was on 10 milligrams. Patients did not know their doses in those days, and when he saw a paper that had been published with his initials at 10 milligrams, he was stunned by that. During these early days of methadone is a very bitter tasting medication, and Marie and I sat down with I'm lucky. Another senior moment. The physician who was the head of the hospital, there was methadone, pure methadone, liquid methadone, and we had various kinds of orange juice and other juices and Tang. And Marie and I would put the tips of our fingers into the methadone. I don't know if you want to put this in your history.
Oh, this is great.
And we would see how bitter it was. And I don't remember which of us suggested Tang, but it's what the astronauts were.
Yes.
It was getting a lot of publicity.
That's then. My association with it as a child, yeah. Was the astronauts.
I mean, and we thought, well, if the astronauts like it, we tried the Tang, and we thought it might be a good, and that's what we used for years.
Yes, that's funny. That's the kind of thing that oral histories turn up that you otherwise is really lost. So that's wonderful. All right. So when you were working with patients, when she was screening them so that they were basically good candidates, was that?
Well, she screened them in the beginning. Subsequent to that first group, we both interviewed and evaluated patients. Mm-hmm. And that's just a message.
What were the interviews and evaluations like?
Well, we wanted to know how long they had used heroin. But we would go through a whole drug history. What was the first drug you ever used? Did we ever smoke? Because cigarettes were generally the first drug. And we wanted to know the age at which they started, when they became dependent on the medication, what their educational background was, what their family history was. Had they ever been arrested? Had they ever spent any time in jail or prison? What was their work history? And in the very early days, we eliminated patients who were using barbiturates or cocaine. I mean, we subsequently found that our histories were not as accurate as we would have liked them to be. But we would write little notes to ourselves. And she was so experienced in the field, but we found that we were both right as often as we were wrong. And so,
did you have departures? People who would not stay?
No, we didn't have dropouts.
To what do you attribute that?
Well, selection had played a major role in it, but also it was a remarkable change from the lifestyle they had. They could go back and live with their families, they were accepted. Every week on a Wednesday after work at 5 o'clock, because the patients all got jobs then, or they were in school. But at 5 o'clock on Wednesdays, we would meet with the patients. And the group grew, and eventually there were 75 patients. But we knew the patients well. We knew we would go to their confirmations and their bar mitzvahs and their weddings. And it was a very intimate kind of thing. And it was our hope that all clinics were going to be like this. I wasn't there very long because I had to go back and finish my residency at Einstein. And toward the end of my residency, about a month before it ended, Iz Werling, who was the chairman of psychiatry, asked me if I would like to take over the narcotics service.
At Einstein?
Yes. It was then located at Bronx State Hospital, which was affiliated with Einstein. And I very clearly declined, said I really want to go on and do a fellowship. And he pointed out to me that we were in the middle of an epidemic and I had an obligation to do public service. And I, well, let me sleep on it. And the next morning when I went to my office, I found a copy of a letter that he had written to the governor, telling him that he was happy to oblige with his, to agree to his request that we expand the narcotics service. And fortunately, there was a young resident who was just finishing up, who had agreed.
He didn't hear your no very clearly.
Who had agreed to take it over. I was not a young resident. I had worked in television before I went to medical school. And I worked my way through undergraduate school. So I went into his office and I said, Mary, how could you do this? He said, you're going to love it. And the fact is, before long, I started a methadone program right away. We had a long waiting list and no money. And so I went to Herman Badillo, who was the borough president, to ask him if he could help us. He pointed out that I was very naive, that borough presidents had no power, but that I, as a private citizen, did. And so I was able to start a committee with the help of Mary Lasker and Matilda Krim. And we got the dean, the chairman of medicine and psychiatry of all the local schools to agree to be on our board. And Herman was part of the committee, too.
And what was the committee? Do you remember the name? Or?
It was a committee for the advancement of methadone maintenance.
Yes. Okay.
And
how did you get Mary Lasker involved?
Through Matilda Prim.
Yes.
And also through a labor leader, Irving. Herman would remember.
I was just going to say, it's in Herman's interview. I think I do remember. Yes.
And we got a wonderful black physician who had his foot in both camps, Democrats and Republicans, to be the chair of the committee.
And who is that?
His name may come. There's a hospital that's named after him in the Bronx.
So you really became a champion of methadone maintenance.
It's something one had to do in order to help. With the help of Mary Lasker and Matilda Krim, we were able to hire an executive secretary who could gather all the data. And when we had that, Beatrice Burley, does that name mean anything to you?
No.
She was the wife of Adolph Burley, who was in Roosevelt's kitchen cabinet, and under Secretary of State, and then he became ambassador to Brazil. And very interested in Latin American affairs, and so was Rockefeller had worked with him, and they were friendly. So once our work was done, we had all the data we needed.
Beatrice called the governor and said, Nelson, we need $10 million in New York for methadone maintenance. What do we do? Well, he told her, he laid it out how we had to get a Republican senator who would take us to Duryea and Anderson, who were head of the Assembly and the Senate, and they would get us to his office. So I went to Albany with Beatrice and Alice Fordyce, these old-time New Yorkers, and we sat in the office of Senator Calandra, who used the kind of language that I certainly was familiar with, but was embarrassed that here were Alice and Beatrice, and it didn't seem to bother them at all.
And what sort of language? Hmm? What?
Well, he called the head of DAC, the Drug Abuse Commission at the time, and he said, you get your fat ass over here. I have some people here who need funds for methadone maintenance, and if you don't meet their demands, you'll never get another fucking program.
Well, at that time, had you had interaction with DAC, with the state?
Oh, well, I personally hadn't, but I had had interaction with the Commissioner of Health, but very, very limited. We got $10 million.
And when you, what year?
In 1970. And I can't, it might have been a little later, but I think it was 70. And the dean of the medical school and I went down to the governor's office. I have a picture of the governor and Lake Scheinberg and myself with this big check for $2.5 million. And the rest went to the city. By that time, Bob Newman was involved. Herman had recruited him. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
They met in an elevator.
Yes, in his apartment building.
They lived in the same building. They used the same elevator. And it was one of Herman's many contributions in the program. And when Bob met Marie, he was sold. And he originally set up a detox unit on a boat downtown. And then when we got the $7.5 million for the rest of the city, he was able to get 10,000 people into treatment in 1 year.
Yeah, it's impressive.
He's just extraordinary. I had a lot of problems getting space. And I was invited by a woman named Carolyn Goodman, who was the mother of Bobby Goodman, one of the three boys that was killed in Mississippi.
Oh.
And she invited me up to her summer home and invited the Zwirlings. Zwirling was the chairman. And her guest house was a converted prefab trailer. I said to Iz, now, if you can use a trailer for a guest house, why can't I have one for a clinic? And I put one up. And he said, okay. I said, if I can do one, how about two? And he knew George Fox, who was a philanthropist in New York and a builder, and George Fox and I worked together, and these two trailers were built, and they're there to this day. Although they are being replaced. They've finally broken ground for a building. So that they were there for 35 years.
That's amazing.
And anyway, that what Beatrice Burley was work. Can't say she really worked for me. She wasn't kind of a very powerful woman.
Yes.
Where this is not relevant to just a sidetrack. She was a general physician, family practitioner, and wherever her husband went, whether it was in Brazil or Washington or New York, she would set up a family clinic. And she had set up a clinic in East Harlem and discovered that every family had at least one heroin addict, and she knew nothing about addiction. And she called Marie Niceweiler, and Marie began to work with her in that clinic. So when we started to expand, Marie recruited her, and that's something that I just recalled. I opened another outpatient clinic at St. Luke's Hospital.
When did you do that?
During that short period that I was working down at Beth Israel. And I opened that clinic, and because I had to go back to my residency, Beatrice Burley came in and took over that clinic.
Oh, I see.
And then when I got the funds to start my own clinics, I persuaded Beatrice to come up and work with me.
Yes, all right. So tell me, I'm having trouble, there are so many clinics involved, I'm having trouble, when you returned to Einstein and you when did you go back to residency?
In 66.
And then?
And I finished my residency in 68.
But during that time, you were starting clinics?
No, not officially. But right after that time, Marie and I started a private clinic at Gracie Square Hospital.
Oh. Okay.
And
why did you do that?
Because there were patients who did not want to be to go down to Bernstein, and they could afford private care.
It's interesting. It's like medical maintenance.
No, because when they could stay in the hospital for 6 weeks, but when they were discharged, they had to go to clinics.
Yes, I see.
Initially, we treated them on an outpatient basis at Gracie Square, but ultimately they went into clinics.
I see. And then after you finished your residency, what did you do immediately after?
That's when I started the narcotic service.
Okay.
At Einstein.
At Einstein. And how long did you do that?
Well, until 95.
Now, when you became a physician, did you envision yourself doing anything like that?
No.
Why had you become a physician?
It's hard to say. I had a lot of medical problems in my family. My father had a stroke at an early age. There's some of my history which I will briefly tell you, but I don't want this included. I was brought up as a Christian Scientist. And I was a member of the Mother Church, and that doesn't belong in this. And when my father had a stroke, I was 16. And my practitioner told me I shouldn't visit my father in the hospital. That was a house of evil. So I was at the hospital every day for 3 months while he was there. And that was when I initially became interested in medicine.
But running the narcotics service for more than 30 years.
Well, because I was running this large service, I had 9 clinics in the Bronx. These clinics were considered among the best, which is kind of sad because we had to have 300 patients in a clinic. It was hard to recruit the kind of staff that we originally had. There was already a stigma attached to methadone maintenance. If we hadn't gone to Rockefeller when we did, it was before he passed the drug laws that we're still living with.
Yes.
We wouldn't have gotten the money.
Yes. So I was planning to ask you about stigma later, but since it came up, can you tell me, clearly there was a stigma against heroin addicts, but you're saying that a stigma formed very early towards people who were on methadone.
Right.
Can you tell me how you knew that, what you observed in the early days?
Well, it was predictable. It was predictable because it was a way of treating addicts. And at that time, drug-free programs had just started, like Daytop Village. That was the first Daytop. And then Phoenix House. And the allegations were that we were just substituting one drug for another. It was like substituting scotch for bourbon.
And you heard that allegation very early on.
Very early. Well, in the early days, we would have visitors come down to meet patients. And we'd have a group of patients and, say, a group from a therapeutic community. And they would make these allegations. Then we had a meeting with all the commissioners. And Dr. Dole described the program, and one of the commissioners turned to Norman Gordon, of all people, and said, "How long have you been on methadone?" Because it really was hard to tell the difference between somebody who's on methadone, and by then they were average human beings. And I use the same technique in teaching medical students. I would have pairs of medical students interview either a patient or a staff member. They wouldn't know which it was. And they could never guess. The one question they couldn't ask was whether they had ever used heroin or whether they were on methadone. But in talking to them about their lives, they could not make a distinction.
Yes, yes. Now, did you experience any of the harassment from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics or the NDD or DEA?
We never had a meeting where there wasn't an FDA representative. Dr. Dole would send me out to speak publicly, and we knew there was always someone from the FDA. But
now, do you mean the FBN?
Pardon?
Do you mean the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, the law enforcement
FDA.
Side, or the FDA? You do mean the FDA, okay. And what was going on with the FDA?
Well, they were concerned about the use of this medication, this pain medication, for the treatment of heroin addicts. And they had not given their approval. We were still operating under an IND.
Yes. And how long were you operating under an IND? When did you stop?
I really don't remember. But I can tell you that Ed Salsitz, who has a medical maintenance program down at Beth Israel, still has an IND.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I know that the FDA in the 1970s was interested in reining in the proliferation of methadone programs,
yes.
What they viewed as the proliferation of it. And they tried to promulgate guidelines that were pretty restrictive.
Yep.
You must have had to deal with that.
Yes.
And what do you remember about that?
Well, I had very little to do with that. I just carried on my own affair. Jerry Jassy had a lot to do with that. There were other people who were involved. Vince would send me down to Fort Worth, say, to discuss methadone.
You went to Fort Worth?
Yeah, there was a meeting at Fort Worth, and
at the Narcotics Hospital?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Tell me about Fort Worth.
Well, I saw Fort Worth was going down a flight. It wasn't Gonzalez. The New York City Addiction Commissioner.
Sure, I know who you mean.
Very nice fellow, but very anti-methadone. But a group of us.
Ramirez.
We're on our way.
Was it Ramirez?
Ramirez, yes. To visit the ward. And I missed a step and I sprained my ankle rather badly. So that I never did get any further than the infirmary. But all the other speakers at this conference were drug-free. Including Ramirez, because I had a sprained ankle and I was in a wheelchair, they were treating me very gently. And Vince told me I could not have a written paper. I had to speak off the cuff. So everybody was very sympathetic. That is to say, they modified their criticisms of methadone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Did you ever go to Lexington?
No.
So Fort Worth. So tell me about your efforts. At what point did you start doing education in medical schools?
At what point I started?
Did you start doing education in medical schools?
Oh, you mean with medical students?
Yes.
That was after we started our program, and we had patients there who were able to interact with the students.
And had you learned anything when you were in med school about
Not
drug addiction?
I think there was one lecture on narcotics, not on nurse. It wasn't called narcotic addiction. By Jerry Jaffe. And he did speak about
it. Oh, of course, he was there.
And we were a class of 96, and he said, one or two of you will wind up addicted to narcotics. Subsequently, three of my classmates consulted me because they were addicted to Demerol. Mm-hmm. So if three came to me, we were over Jerry's estimate.
Yes, yes. I thought you were going to say one or two of you will become interested in the problem of drug addiction, and you were the one. But did you remain involved in teaching medical students during most of your career?
Well, I remained at Methodo at Einstein as the director of the Division of Substance Abuse. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, at what point did you take on the project of the textbook?
Well, I was appointed to the President's Strategy Council on Drug Abuse Prevention.
When?
By Carter. This was okay. In 77. And there were six of us. There was David Musto, mm-hmm. Vernon Jordan, Harvey Sloan, who was then mayor of Lexington, an international police officer, and one other person. And after we were sworn in, I called Vernon, since we were both New Yorkers, and invited him to breakfast. I was living in Pierre at the time. And I had never had breakfast downstairs, but it was one of those power breakfasts. It was like the Regency. And Vernon came in and he stopped at every table. This is not for your notes. I shouldn't even say it because that's on. But
we can strike
it. And then when he finally sat down, a lot of people came over to us. And Vernon thought I was very optimistic if I felt we would really be able to accomplish anything. He knew a lot about government that I didn't know. And David Musto and I tried very hard to make some changes, but we were not very effective.
The what kinds of changes did you and David Musto?
Well, we wanted to open up, we were aware of the stigma and the federal governments and what was going on with the FDA. And at that time, I think we already had a DEA. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I accomplished while I was on that council was to set up an interinstitutional committee on pain, mm-hmm. which is the field I was interested in, but really didn't have the time to work in that area.
Yes, but would it be fair to say that that emerged as one of your primary interests later?
It would.
Pain emerged as one of your primary interests mm-hmm. later?
I succeeded in getting a license in acupuncture in, I think, 72. And I don't needle people, but I was always very supportive of it. And initially, there had been a study in Hong Kong by a neurosurgeon by the name of Wen, who succeeded in detoxifying, it was 9 narcotics addicts using acupuncture. And so I happened to be on my way to Hong Kong with my husband. It was part of a series of meetings I was going to. And I spent a week working with Dr. Nguyen and came back here and took a course. And then I became president of the New York Society of Acupuncture for Physicians.
And did you end up doing any more on acupuncture for the treatment of addiction?
Well, we've tried it, but it hasn't really been successful. It is helpful in detoxifying people. And in fact, I think Mitch Rosenthal introduced it at Phoenix House. A number of years before he introduced it, I suggested that to him, and he was not in favor of using anything, because like most of the directors of therapeutic communities, he had been at Sidenham. He and Monsignor O'Brien and most of them came from that school, and they've all modified their approach, but at that time, they were still opposed to it. But now it's turned out to be very useful.
So let me also ask you, I was going to ask you about other alternatives to methadone. Did you try at all LAM?
Yes, we did use LAM for a brief period. And it was effective with a number of patients. Some patients preferred it to methadone, but most of the patients preferred methadone. And then it was taken off the market. Mm-hmm. We couldn't use it. Mm-hmm. No, we never had enough time to do the right kind of studies. Bob Millman and I served on a committee down at NIDA, and we made some recommendations for changes in the study, but the outcome was that they decided to eliminate the medication, which was, in my opinion, a great mistake.
And why was it a mistake?
Because it does work for some people, it, and it works better for them.
And why do you think it was eliminated?
These committees make recommendations, they don't make laws.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So tell me, when do you remember first becoming involved with NIDA?
Well, when Jerry Jaffe, I knew Walter Tkach, who was Nixon's personal physician. And whenever I went to Washington, I would go and have lunch with him at the White House. During that period, methadone administrators would meet monthly in Washington, and that included people like Benny Prim, mm-hmm. and Ed Sine and Bob Newman, and Jerry Jaffe became the, I'm leaving out something, but I want to leave it out. Jerry Jaffe became director of the Special Action Office, and he proliferated. He really did a decent job in getting methadone clinics started all over the country. And I'm sure you know from Jerry why Nixon took that step.
Yes.
That there was a lot of crime in Washington, and Bob DuPont had a methadone clinic. And then Bob became the first director of NIDA. And I don't recall exactly what year it was, but it was, I think the Vietnam War was still on.
73 was the inception of NIDA, 74 is when it really begins.
Yeah.
And so you were involved from the earliest days?
Well, we all were, but it was kind of was not so formal as it is today, and NIDA was very accessible. Bob DuPont was very accessible.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the National Drug Abuse Conference. Would typically go to that, and then you?
Well, I chaired that conference in New York. I co-chaired it in New Orleans. And when I chaired it here, I decided that since alcohol was a drug, we should include it. And so I called Berkeley Smithers, and we had some discussions. And he was very helpful to us, and he gave us funds for alcohol sessions on alcoholism, and we, I, I think it took a long time for people to recognize that alcohol is a drug. And certainly in 12-step programs, AA, they did not want to be connected with heroin addicts.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Did Herman tell you that Dr. Dole was a good friend of Bill W.?
I believe he did.
That he, Dr. Dole, was on the medical advisory board of AA. He gave you that information?
You know, I know that, but I'm not sure. I don't remember if it was Herman's interview. But it's been of interest to me because of the... Dole was not someone who was drug-free. He had a different approach.
Hmm. And Bill W. Told me, that, you know, AA is wonderful when it works, but it only works for about 20% of the people who enter and who go to AA meetings. And he persuaded Vince to work on the development of an analog of methadone for alcoholics.
He did. And was Vince working on that?
And the first group of rats that Vince worked with, I think they were Lewis rats, didn't like alcohol. They wouldn't go near it. Which may imply that there is a genetic factor. And he then started to use other species. And he never succeeded in finding anything that would replace alcohol.
Has anyone written about that you recall?
Yes, I think he had written about it.
He had some papers on it?
I think so. Ask Herman.
Yes, I will.
Because Herman, I went through a lot of the archives with Vince when he was still working, getting them, sending them up to the archives. But Herman went through a lot more in the last year of Vince's life and after that, mm-hmm. after Vince died. Mm-hmm. And he really has a very broad and deep understanding of the various phases
yes.
of Vince's work.
Yes, yes.
But out of that group came Enoch Gordis, who became director of NIAAA.
Yes, yes. Very interesting. All right. The textbook. When did you start doing the textbook?
That's why I mentioned the Strategy Council. Because when I was on the Strategy Council, a number of different publishers wanted me to do a textbook. And I wasn't interested. I didn't really feel I had the time for it. Pedro Ruiz was at Einstein at that time. He was head of the Lincoln Community Mental Health Center, which was closed down. And he started to work with me, and he persuaded me that if we did a textbook, he and I, I knew everybody in the field, he didn't. I could outline the book, get the contributors, and he would do all the legwork. Well, right after we signed the contract, the Lipping Cup, he was appointed director of the Bronx State Hospital. They shut up. Hugh Butts was the director at that time. Really very fine psychiatrist, black psychiatrist. And he was having problems with the state, and they they shut him out of his office and put Pedro in. Fortunately, at that time, there was a woman working for me, Lois Olksney, who was a librarian, and John Langbrook, who were able to step in and do a lot of the legwork. And then for the next edition, we recruited Bob Millman.
And so was that in the late 1970s that the first edition came out?
First edition came out in 81.
Okay. And how did you conceptualize it? I assume the organization was yours.
Yes.
And can you tell me a little bit about how you were thinking about the field at the time?
Well, you start out with the history and the epidemiology of the field, and then some of the triggers, the causes of addiction. Yeah.
The etiology?
No.
Would that have been a term?
Right.
Okay.
And then we had sections on different on treatment and medical aspects. And
did you subdivide it by drug category?
We did, yes.
And at that point, were you? It is called substance abuse.
Yeah.
Can you? Is that a term that you would have used at the beginning of your career, or did that come in later?
I think it came in later, and I introduced it because I wanted to make this a division of substance abuse, which would be more acceptable at the medical school.
And you saw substance abuse as a term that would be...
I assume there was less stigma attached to that than to addiction.
Yes. And was it a term that you picked up on elsewhere, or did you come up with it?
I don't know that anything's really original.
Right, but... So you don't remember...
Bob Newman told me recently that he was reading something about Dorothy Niswander, who was Marie's mother, very famous public health doctor.
Yes.
And she was writing about the open society. And he had always thought it was Soros who had invented that. So did I? It's like opiophobia. I think that David Musto was the first to introduce that term, but you will hear from other people and somebody else. I don't remember that how I started to use it.
Was it in the air, I suppose, is what I'm trying to... You don't remember a specific reference.
No.
But my
recollection is that I created that. But I'm sure that somewhere I had heard it.
Yes, but it's interesting. I'm trying to get at the... It seems to me to do a different kind of work than addiction or even drug dependence. Mm. That had to do with the inclusion of alcohol, tobacco, etc.
Very early on, I stopped using the term heroin addict.
Mm-hmm. Because of the stigma?
Because I had a pharmacist named James Clare who felt that it was a very stigmatizing term, and that we should say we were working with people who were dependent on heroin. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, and gradually, you see, maybe it was Jimmy Clare, my great tennis partner. I just don't remember, but you can see that I don't have a very good memory in general.
To tell you the truth, almost no one does. I mean, one of the things I've learned doing oral histories is that a lot of it is retrospective. You get the transcript, and there are these things that you've forgotten that you fill in later because mm-hmm. you have better recall because they've been kind mm-hmm. of primed during the talking session.
But so. Well, I'm sure you found that Herman had a very good...
Herman was great.
Because
Herman always remembered.
He's been writing about this, mm-hmm. and it's...
It helped that he did that dissertation, actually, because he put a lot of dates and names into mm-hmm. the dissertation. That helped a lot. So tell me, at what point would you have first heard of buprenorphine?
At what point I would have first heard of what?
Buprenorphine.
Oh, I knew that buprenorphine was an analgesic. And I can't remember when I first heard it was going to be used that research. Oh, yes, I can. In 1977, see, you're very good. Jasinski gave a paper at a conference that Bob Milman and I chaired at the New York Academy of Sciences.
What was that conference?
Pardon?
What was the conference?
I don't remember the name of the conference. We gave so many conferences. It was a small conference with a couple of hundred people. And and it was a fascinating idea. I thought for a long while that it was the first paper he had ever presented on it. He says it may have been the second. He may have presented it at CPDD first. But for a long while I said, I thought it was, our conference was the first. And how many years it took before it really took off. And while there was a lot of opposition among many people working in methadone maintenance, Vin Stoll had a very open mind about it. He said, we need alternatives.
That's very interesting.
Methadone is not a panacea, and methadone won't work for everyone. And buprenorphine may help some of those people. And also, from my perspective, buprenorphine gave a window of opportunity to young people who hadn't used heroin very long. Mm-hmm. And they could be switched to buprenorphine, maintained on that for a while they thought about what they wanted to do. If they wanted to be drug-free, they could. If they wanted to go on methadone, they could. And at that time, I was not thinking in terms of maintaining them on buprenorphine. Mm-hmm. Because we heard mostly about detoxifying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, the idea of medical maintenance, when would you say that came in?
Oh, very early. That was Marie's idea.
Mm-hmm.
And she started a medical maintenance program at Beth Israel with David Novick.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very careful about the selection of patients.
Yes, and that seems to be key with medical maintenance.
Yeah. And it's not all, you don't always make the right choice. Some people have to go back to the program, but are you planning on speaking to Ed Salsitz?
I don't know.
Because he took over the medical maintenance program when Novick left.
I see.
And he uses both methadone and buprenorphine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. You also became very interested in the undertreatment of chronic pain. How early did that interest you?
I've long been interested. I can't tell you when that started, but I had Russ Portnoy do a chapter in the second edition of our book on the treatment of pain in the chemically dependent, because it was clear to me that our patients were not getting the proper care. And a lot of this goes to David Novick, who was not yet a hepatologist, but he was very interested in hepatology.